Now we'll take a look at East Asia in world political structure, how it is situated within the world politics and economics. Let's take a look at great powers. The biggest economic area in the world is the European Union, followed by the United States. These have been here counted in thousand billions of US dollars using market value calculations, and IMF is the source of this information. The year is 2011. China is today the third biggest economic area, or second biggest if we calculate only states. It passed Japan a couple of years ago and continues growing quite fast, trailing the USA and the European Union. Germany is next, then France, and Brazil, another country that used to be called Third World previously, has already entered in this level. Another graph, when we are using purchasing power parities, which describe better than currency-based calculations, the welfare level of people. Because, for instance, when you go to a barber in an expensive country like Finland, or when you go to a barber in China, you can buy the service with less money. And these calculations describe much better the level of human beings. On the other hand, we should not forget these currency-based calculations, because they describe better the way companies, individuals, or states in specific countries can invest abroad. Well, European Union is still the biggest, but the USA is almost the same. This is because European Union is overpriced. Just like also Japan, whose position falls quite clearly down. It used to be not much smaller than China in the previous chart. Here it is clearly less than half of China now. And China is no more very far behind USA and European Union in this. Which means that the level of life of Chinese people is much higher, actually, than many Europeans tend to think nowadays. Then we have India, which also rises quite high because of its big population and its economic development level. Germany is the only Western European single state that can still stay in these charts, but it will drop down before long. And Russia has replaced here Brazil, because Russian level of life is a bit higher. China, Japan, and India also can now be seen as big players in the world, because they are fairly rich, at least in terms of their states. The USA still is the leader of the world. It is the so-called hegemon, which organizes important international organizations and creates a normative basis of conduct in the world. And US foreign policy is to a large extent dictated by what happened during the Second World War. Because at that time, when Germany, Japan, and their allies were both fighting against the USA, it found itself being encircled by these Eurasian powers. And as the world is getting smaller and smaller, the USA is more and more a single island in this world. And there's no wish in its leadership to be encircled by any kind of enemies. So the way USA can control the rest of the world is to encircle it and control the old continent from both sides. The old continent, basically Eurasia and also Africa, from now on, more and more important. It is so important because most of humankind is living there. Population is there. Most of the economic activity of the world is situated in the old world. And most of military power also is there, combined. The most important places in the old world is the so-called Rimland, a name used, for instance, by Niklas Spykman in his geopolitical map of Eurasia. This idea was published in 1945 at the later stages of the war as a plan on what to do, how to create a peaceful world where the USA can be the leader. It's not important to control the heartland, the inner areas of Eurasia. There's always some strong power there. Sometimes it has been Mongols, after that the Russians. It could be somebody else in the future. But it is not a fertile area. It is cold, has long distances. You can create a great power there, but not a power that can control the rest of the world. The Rimland, where the most population is, where most economic activity is the most important place. Zbigniew Brzeziński is a more modern geopolitician whose book, The Grand Chessboard, was published in 1997, but it is still very good to read if you are interested in world geopolitics. The idea here is that when he has been advisor to American presidents, starting from Carter, mainly Democrat presidents, and he's originally Polish, and he can be proud of the fact that he was the guy who brought Soviet Union down, because he created a plan to lure Soviet Union to fight in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is a difficult place to fight. It is this final war is what brought Soviet Union down into its collapse. So a Polish guy, Brzeziński, brought Soviet Union down with the help of many other actors. What he says about U.S. geopolitics is that the United States can control all the oceans of the world. And it has a structural allies also around the world. Either they are parts of military alliances like NATO or ANZUS, Australia, New Zealand, United States, the military alliance. Well, then they are neutrals, who nevertheless are associated with these military alliance countries, like Finland or Sweden. We tend to support US policies when there is a strong need. And most of the allies of the United States are fairly advanced industrial powers. In East Asia, Japan, South Korea, some extent Taiwan, also military connected with the USA, and there are others that tend to support it when needed. It's not only the Rimland, but especially the western and eastern ends of Eurasia that has to be kept under US control. They are the so-called handles from which you can keep the rest of the world under your power. Any state, even a so strong state like United States, would not be able to control the world by itself. It needs aliens. The power comes from aliens, not from the economic community power or any individual single state. Alliance is what creates a world power. So Western Europe and Eastern Asia are places where it's important for the USA to be present. Sometimes we are nowadays discussing the concept of world state. Do we have a kind of system like that? And the idea goes back to Thomas Hobbes, his book Leviathan, where he describes how states are formed. We need a society. We need a leader. And we need a social contract, binding the members of the society together to support the leader. Just like in world politics, also in domestic politics, power does not come from any strong individual actor. But Leviathan is a body composed of all the bodies of the citizens of the state. Do we have nowadays a world Leviathan, which would also be controlling East Asia? And if we have, does he have this kind of face, Barack Obama, President of the United States? We may have. Even if we don't have this kind of Leviathan, unify the world, we have a kind of acting government of the world. It used to be called G7, which was composed of USA, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, United Kingdom, also the European Union was represented. In this organization, only Japan represented something that was not part of the Western European, North American area. And it was the only Asian representative in this organization. Since 2009, a number of new members were added. China, India, Brasilia, Russia, Argentina, Australia, Indonesia, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, South Korea, and Turkey. And in this organization, not only Japan, but also China, India, Australia, Indonesia, and South Korea are strongly represented. What do they discuss in these meetings? Well, they discuss economics of the world, they can discuss internet, they can discuss diseases like the avian flu and so on. The agenda in these meetings is quite similar what it would be in any state, government or cabinet meeting. They are dealing with world domestic politics. If you go to look at the communiques published by the organization after the meetings, it is mostly dominated by US agenda. United States sets the basic agenda, basic text, basic arguments, and other members can then add small things here and there. So it is still the leader of the world, using G20 as its government. If we think the old realist theoretical understanding of the world by Hans Morgenthau, in his book Politics Among Nations, he divided the important countries of the world into two groups. The small states don't play much a role here. He divided the countries into status quo powers. They are powers who are in a good position in the world. They are powerful. They form the nucleus of international organizations. They form the normative structure of the international trading, military regime. And these old established powers, like the European Union, the USA, Japan, clearly belong to these status quo powers. They benefit from the structure of the world. Normally, states that grow fast are with Morgenthau's conceptions called imperialistic powers. Imperialism here does not mean colonies. It simply means wish or policy to upset the power balance of the world and become the new norm setters. And theoretically, China, India, Indonesia, Asia in general, all states except Japan in Asia, or when Australia, New Zealand, they also belong to status quo powers, belong to these imperialistic powers. And there's supposed to be tension between status quo powers and imperialistic powers. Tension that shows itself in everyday diplomacy, international policy, in various kinds of moves to balance situations. And we can actually see this kind of tension there. If you go to look at, more minutely, the feudal global governance structure, it resembles medieval system. Not a modern state, which is very, very tight, closely knit, well governed, well integrated, but a situation where we have a leader and who is helped by so-called vassals, grand vassals, who are quite independent, mostly minding their own affairs, sometimes fighting with each other, but ready to come to the rescue and help of the leader when needed. When we look at the international conflicts, USA is always called to come to help, to solve the situation. It gallops to the place, then it calls for friends to help it, either to send troops to Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, wherever, to participate in trade embargoes or hand out money to bail out the countries in distress or whatever. And countries like Britain, Canada, Japan, Germany, France, South Korea, Australia usually come to the rescue. Not always, because they are also independent states. Sometimes there is quarrel with the USA, but most of them tend to obey. China does not usually oppose US policies. Sometimes it refrains from helping. Sometimes it has its own agenda and it wants something for helping, but sooner or later it also normally aligns itself with the same position with the other vassals. China is benefiting greatly from the present international regime, its growth, is based on being a good member in this regime. So it usually also aligns itself here. The other arm of this governance structure is international organizations. G20, we discussed, United Nations, especially its Security Council, where the United States is represented. IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. It's normally divided between European Union and USA. United States normally appoints the leader of World Bank, and European Union normally appoints the leader of IMF, so it is divided between two actors. European Union is also an organization where USA is not represented, but it doesn't need to be represented here because its grand vassals, so many of them, are represented there. Then we have free trade area, the Americas. We have East Asia Summit that we just discussed, where USA participated last year, became a member. Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, APEC, which is an older, soon 20 years old organization, also covering many Latin American and East Asian countries. Or the Asia Europe meeting, which takes place biannually, every 2 years. USA is not a member here. It's composed of East Asian and Western European countries. But still, it tends to support the world governance structure. There is also an old theory of hegemonic chains. We all probably have heard that China, because it is rising so fast, may replace the USA as the leader of the world. Or that there will be conflict between China and the USA. Some even say in the near future. This can of course happen, but it is not very likely. If we follow this theory, there are many variants of this theory of hegemonic chains, but Inoguchi Takashi's, a Japanese political scientist theory, already 21 years old, is quite sensible from my point of view. So hegemon, like the USA, it has a strong economy, strong military, its culture spreads throughout the world. I am speaking to you in English, and you understand probably my English. It is also supposed to have a fairly big population, but it does not have to be the biggest in this sense. And it takes care of the world governance. And it has supporters. And relative productivity is an important concept also here. It means, well, basically, good economy. Good, efficient economies, able to produce goods, also military hardware, but also strong economies in general. It is high here, in the side of the hegemon. And the supporters of the hegemon also tend to be high in the sense of relative productivity. In world history, the hegemons always also have had opposing states. The USA used to be opposed by the Soviet Union, which collapsed. Britain was the hegemon before the USA, and it used to be opposed by Germany. Britain was more efficient than Germany was. Before Germany, the opponent of Britain was France, and so on. There is tends to be this kind of opponent. And the most natural opponent, or the spoiler, who tries to break down the system created by the hegemon, the most natural one would be the country with the second strongest economy in the world. There was a time when Soviet Union was the second strongest state in the world, both in terms of its economy and especially its military. But its relative productivity was lower. It tends to have supporters, an earlier structure, whose members also are lower in terms of relative productivity. Then we have lots of also weak states in the world, but they are not so important here. And the important thing here is that a new hegemon practically never in world history thus far, has come from this spoiler category. The enemy of the hegemon does not become a new hegemon. The reason is that the structure, all this supporting structure, the whole governance structure, is so strong that it tends to wear out the possible opponent. And so Soviet Union went bankrupt. And for the past 20 years, we have not had a real state actor in this position. But the structure demands somebody to be there, because only a good enemy can create integration and reason for unity here among the hegemon and its support. Islamic terrorists have been placed in the role of the spoilers for the past 20 years. They're not only Islamic ones, but they have been in the center. Of course, they are very weak. They are not able to threaten the governance structure of the world, but they have been placed in this role so that the whole rest of the whole world can be unified in fight against them. And if we don't any state, well, okay, we had also Iraq here for a while, Saddam Hussein's Iraq. But as everybody knows, it didn't last long. China is clearly in a position where the world political discussion, speculation, argumentation tries to place it in this role. And actually, if we remember old things, 20 years old things, Japan also was used to be placed in this role in the early 1990s. But the Japanese said, no thanks, we don't want this role. Stepped out, started growing rapidly, and created themselves domestic problems, and sort of faded out of the news of the world. So there was, after Soviet Union, there was Japan for a short while, then the Islamic terrorists, and China is being placed in this role. And China is quite reluctant into taking this role now. And we can see this dynamic also in East Asia. Will somebody oppose, become an enemy of the USA is one of the factors that also defined the East Asian situation nowadays. That's it.